This is National Sound Archive tape T10271WR, and this is track W. And this tape comprises recordings borrowed from the BBC Sound Archives and being copied on the 9th of May 1991. And all these recordings feature the poetess Ruth Pitter, although there are one or two other tracks and bands of other material amongst these recordings. The first one I shall transfer is BBC Sound Archives LP 23052. Personal Call, Ruth Pitter interviewed by Stephen Black. This was transmitted on a network which the BBC had in those days entitled London Calling Asia on the 24th of October 1955, having been recorded the previous 19th of October. This is a double-sided 10-inch LP. Total duration 27 minutes and 17 seconds, and I shall join the two sides up.
Our death implicit in our birth we cease or cannot be, and know when we are laid in earth we perish utterly. And equally the spirit knows the indomitable sense of immortality which goes against all evidence. See faith alone, whose hand unlocks all mystery at a touch, embrace the awful paradox, nor wonder overmuch.
The Paradox by Ruth Pitter. She's just read me the poem, sitting here in her house, the Hawthorns, in the village, or just outside the village, of Long Crendon, on the border between Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire. Ruth Pitter is a lady, I don't like to ask her age. She's a lady of, shall I say, middle age, Miss Pitter?
Well, I'm a Jubilee baby. I was born in Queen Victoria's Jubilee year of 97.
Miss Pitter, you seem to be smiling at the world the whole time. What is it that you enjoy so much about it all?
It would be hard to say. I enjoy so much of it to such a high degree. I have never lost my interest and wonder in plant life. Every little bird and every plant there is about the door to me is an inexhaustible mine of felicity, and every kind and good neighbour. I feel like Blake. I love them like the little bird that picks up crumbs about the door.
Miss Pitter, how long have you been writing poetry?
I've been writing poetry for more than half a century, ever since I was 5 years old.
Ever since you were five?
Ever since I was 5 years old.
Can you remember any of the poems you wrote when you were five?
Yes, indeed, I still have copies of them, done in blue pencil, in block letters. And the very first poem I ever wrote, I remember, was a poem about a desolate and abandoned place. That was the first thing that ever gave me a poetic sensation.
Can you remember the poem?
It began, "The old mill stands with broken shaft." I think that line's fairly poetical, but not the rest of it.
And when did you first have anything published?
Oh, very early. That was rather unwise, I think. My father was very proud and pleased with what I'd been doing, and he took me, as a cat takes its kitten in its mouth, and showed me to an editor who printed some of my work. I was then not quite 14 years old.
What did your father do?
My father was an assistant elementary schoolmaster.
He was very pleased at this, was he?
Extremely pleased, but he used to edit my work, of which I disapproved very much.
Did he improve it, do you think, looking back?
No, he put schoolmaster's emendations into it, not poet's emendations.
Was there any other poetry? Had he written poetry?
No, but he loved it very much, especially simple poetry, such as William Blake's Songs of Innocence.
When your work was first published, when your first book was published, did the critics take notice of it?
Oh, yes, rather more than it deserved, I think. I think I've been happy in my critics. I've been taken a good deal of notice of, because other things being equal, what a woman does is always news. And my first poems, which were not at all good, I think, had very good press, considering. I'm afraid I didn't write any mature work, though I've been writing for so long. I certainly didn't write anything mature until I was well past 30. I'm afraid till I was at least 25 I believed in fairies.
So you didn't in fact come up against the problem of being criticised and knowing what it felt like to have people saying unkind things about your work?
No, not very much. I've not lived in that world at all.
You escaped from that?
Yes. I had enough of it at home with my brothers and sisters and schoolfellows. And I determined to squeeze all the water out of my work if I possibly could and make it parody-proof.
How many brothers and sisters did you
have? I had one of each, both younger than myself.
And they laughed at your writing, did they?
Oh, yes, and so did my young uncles and aunts, of whom I had plenty. It was awful. I used to illustrate my own work at times, and they used to find it. And would say dreadful things such as, very, very nice, I'm glad we have seen the above touching diagram.
Written on it. Did that hurt you at all, really?
Oh, it hurt me wildly up to the age of about 14. And after that I became stronger and more cunning and ruthless, and my skin became much thicker, which is a very good thing.
How much thicker? Not thick enough to interfere with what you were doing?
No, the thing is to have a skin that is thick where you want it and thin where you want it. It would be a dreadful thing to lose one's sensibility, and an awful thing not to be able to face life.
Where did you go to school?
I went to school first to an elementary school, one of those huge elementary schools on the outskirts of London, where there were about 1,000 children. And then I went to a secondary school, an old London foundation.
And did you go to the university?
I never did, to my grief, because when World War I broke out, I was then about 16, between 16 and 17. And there was no question of going on. It couldn't be afforded. And I just went and got myself a little job in the War Office. And I got very unhealthy and broke down in health. And I went and took myself a little job on the East Coast, working for some people who were making furniture and painting it. And so I learned woodwork and learned to paint things.
And have you used this technique of woodwork and painting later?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. I've earned my living by it all my life.
You've earned your living with the woodwork and not with the poetry?
Not with the poetry. Oh, never. No. At first, I went and lived with my employers on the East Coast of Suffolk. And then they set up a business in London, and I still lived with them in Kensington. Then, when I got to be 22 years old, I resolved to set up house on my own. And with £50, which I'd made in my spare time, I took two rooms over a stable in a mews and bought some odds and ends of furniture and became a householder. And then I lived like that till about 1930, and then when Kathleen O'Hara and I went into business for ourselves, we set up housekeeping together. At first we lived in a flat in Chelsea, and then we took the whole house where our business was and lived over the business.
Tell me about the business. This furniture, you said it was based on woodwork and painting.
Gradually, we found that the smaller furniture sold better, and from the smaller furniture we graduated to still smaller things like tea trays. And I still find the tea trays are the best and most saleable thing. They're very easily sent about, and there are things for which there's always a demand, for wedding presents and the like. So tea trays and plastics are what I now principally paint.
These tea trays over here on the settee, they're
yes,
some
the
of yours,
English papier-mâché trays are my best line, and I still say they're the best in the trade. Our work was always the best in the trade and is still known as the best.
And what, you're working here in Long
yes,
Crendon?
Yes, I work here in Long Crendon and send the work all over England. The most I ever made of poetry in one year was about £175, and I average about £50 to £60 a year from it.
About £1 a week?
Yes, but the little money you do get is very nice money because you don't mind wasting it.
You find it's sort of a little bonus?
Exactly, yes. You feel you can buy a bottle of wine or go to the theatre with money like that.
And yet you've published a lot of books.
Oh, yes, indeed, and my publishers never lost money by me.
They always pay off the books?
Yes, they always pay off. I think that's fair enough.
And
one mustn't expect more.
And you sell your poetry where else, besides publishing it in books?
Oh, hardly at all. I used to send it round to magazines and to American papers, but lately it hardly seemed worth the effort. There are so few papers who take poetry, and the younger people are so eager to get anything printed. It's so hard for them to get a book published that I think the market should be left to the young ones, the journal market.
When you started, though, you couldn't possibly have published them all in one book straight off, did you? You had published them in journals.
Yes, in The New Age, which was edited by A.R. Orridge, which was at that time a very well-known and very advanced socialist weekly with not a very big circulation, but The circulation it had was worldwide.
A socialist weekly. Are you a socialist?
I was brought up a socialist, but I reacted away from it.
You
as
reacted?
People often do.
What sort of poetry do you like?
I like golden age poetry.
Meaning?
I mean the English poetry which is always there, the poetry which finds enough beauty and enough love close to its own door and does not need to use violence or gloom or despair as its materials.
Can you give me an example?
Oh, yes, indeed. The country was full of it in the reign of Elizabeth I. Poetry for which the materials were nature, the songs of birds, the beauties of the landscape, the loveliness of women, the happiness of mere life.
Shakespeare.
Shakespeare, indeed. Shakespeare's lyrics are quite typical. Sir Philip Sidney is quite typical. And, oh, there were a host of Golden Age poets at that time for whom these simple things were quite sufficient.
Miss Bitter, when you're going to write your poetry, is it something that you sit down and you say, I am going to write a poem, I have an idea, or does it come to you, as it were, against your will?
Now, that's very interesting. I have done so. I have churned out work or done work to order, and it's by no means my worst, I find. But in every case of that kind, what one uses is an idea which has lain dormant in one's mind for a long time. In my case, I feel that poems are concepts which have entered the mind perhaps very many years ago, have lain in the unconscious mind for a long time, and at the touch of some stimulus will suddenly emerge as a poem.
With all the feet right and the rhyme?
No, by no means. What first comes is a phrase crystallizing, as it were, out of some medium, crystallizing out of a mood. And round the phrase, the rest of the poem gradually collects and aggregates itself. The phrase may be in the middle of the poem or in any part of it, but you can already tell from the phrase the shape of the rhythm. It will be, as it were, an arc or part of a shape from which the rest can be inferred. The poem is, as it were, an explosion at the centre of one's being, which expresses itself in ripples which gradually reach the periphery. And that the rhythm is decided by the explosion at first and the tempo of the ripples that are set up from it.
That's lovely.
It hits great. One like some great. Energy. In fact, it sometimes, in my youth at least, used to hit me so hard that my eyes watered as though I had been hit on the nose.
With emotion?
Yes, yes.
Does it still hit you like that?
Often, sometimes, yes. Yes, I think so. Quite often.
When you were describing to me how you conjured up a poem, you talked of it lying in the unconscious mind.
Yes.
Were you talking in terms of Freudian psychoanalytic theory?
More or less, because I came in contact with Freud's theory very young. My good old editor, Orridge, was always in search of anything new. He ran through cults about one a week. And when we came up against Freud's theories, it wasn't long before I heard of them. He gave me a great fat book. I think it was Ernest Jones's first book to read. And I at once joined in the delightful game of catching other people out and catching oneself out. And I think it's a bad thing in a way, which stultifies one to a very great extent. You anticipate your own errors, and so you never commit them and tend not to get anywhere.
You get places by making errors.
Oh, I think people do, yes, by taking risks and by getting experience by their failures.
How did you compose a poem like Paradox, which you read at the beginning?
Why, that's so long ago, I hardly remember how that individual poem came. It would be the result of a ferment of philosophical and religious ideas milling together in one's mind.
Is there any such ferment connected with your very delightful poems about cats?
Oh, yes. They represent an attempt to feel one's way into the essential being of the cat. No easy task.
What started this great interest in cats?
Oh, I think it's always been with me. The family loved cats very much. And we as a family have a language which we speak to cats, which sounds very silly to an outsider, but the cats understand it. And I've always realised that they are creatures with a peculiar existence of their own which one longs to share.
Well, I think we must have some of the cat language.
Many a time I've greeted a cat. Fancy, it varies very much with the cat. One speaks a different language to each cat. But one might say, for instance, and the cat, it actually has a meaning to the cat. We had a very large fat cat that I used to call Mum. Well, that's not a word at all, but it was a word to him.
What would you say to the cat if you went into the other room where you gave me tea earlier and you found the cat drinking the milk out of the jug?
I should say at once, I'm so glad, because he never does drink milk and I think he needs it. I should speak plain English on that occasion.
Plain English on that occasion.
Yes.
Would you like to read that poem about cats?
I should love it. This happened on my 21st birthday. And my sister and I were sleeping in the same bed, one at each end. We sat up at the same moment and looked each other wildly in the face, for we heard such a peculiar sound from outside. In a dark garden, by a dreadful tree, the druid Toms were met. They numbered three, Tab Tiger, Demon Black, and Ginger Hate. Their forms were tense, their eyes were full of fate, save the involuntary caudal thrill. The horror was that they should sit so still. An hour of ritual silence passed. Then low and marrow-freezing, Ginger moaned, "Horror!" Two horrid syllables of hellish lore, followed by deeper silence than before. Another hour, the tabby's turn is come. Rigid, he rapidly howls, "Mum, mum, mum!" Then reassumes his silence like a pall, clothed in negation, a dumb oracle. At the third hour, the black gasps out, "Black!" like a lost soul that founders in the murk, and the grim, ghastly, damned, and direful crew resumes its voiceless vigilance anew. The fourth hour passes. Suddenly, all three chant mournfully, then stiffly rise and melt into the shade, their Sabbath over and their demons laid.
Thank you very much. How did that book on cats, on cats sell? That was the title.
Well, I think it sold tolerably well, but I think it's been put in the shade by Mr. Eliot's very well, much better known book on cats.
What is your view of Mr. Eliot's book on cats? What was it called?
It was called Old Possum.
Old Possum.
And his
Practical Cats.
Practical Cats. Yes. Well, it's a type of humour I don't share. I feel that it's faintly arch and much more old maidish than my own, though I am the old maid and Mr. Eliot is not. And although Mr. Eliot's admirers say that there is a great deal of Mr. Eliot in the poems, I never have been able to take much pleasure in them myself.
When did you last write a poem?
Oh, let me see. A few months ago. I think I've only produced one wizened imp of a poem since I've been in this house. There has been so much to do.
You've moved here recently.
We've only been here a year and a half. And the poem I wrote was a little poem about the new house. After all, this is a new house as times go. It is only about 50 years old and very strongly built.
Are you working on a book now?
No, indeed.
Poems from
no, it's always been a slow process with me. Most of my books of serious poems have been the work of 10 years at least, because I don't believe in putting down everything that comes into one's head. I think when poetry does not do good, it does harm, and one should be very careful about writing it down. There's too much facile and undigested poetry written nowadays. And so I'm very careful about it. I feel a kind of stage fright in the presence of poetry. I feel I'm taking up the weapons of the mighty, and they must not be dishonoured.
Have you ever felt that you couldn't face life?
Oh, yes, I feel it all the time. Because, after all, to be a poet is to be preoccupied, emotionally, to be preoccupied with a class of experience that demands solitude and silence above everything. And the one thing one wishes about other people is that they would go away. And I would have been very glad, it seems to me, to have been a recluse. But always having to earn one's living means one cannot be, and then the tension is set up between the necessary dealings with the world and the desire for solitude and silence.
And yet you lived all those long years in the middle of Chelsea, was it?
Yes, hating it all the time.
Hating it, really?
Oh, hating it, because I was so busy that I couldn't get out and share in the nightlife and have a good time. I was simply working in noise and dirt and with the anxiety of a business which I didn't like either, but which was necessary. So I really was in a kind of purgatory.
You never thought of moving out earlier and travelling up to deal with your business?
No, because that would have been a waste of time, I think. One saves a great deal of money and can give much better value if you live with your business in the old-fashioned way.
And you found this solitude, have you, here in this...
Oh, no, it's a very social village indeed. The solitude is actually less than the solitude of Chelsea. In Chelsea, you can shut yourself up if you want to, but this is a village where people call.
And you have to entertain.
Yes, one has to. It can't be helped. One can't disregard one's neighbours and fellow creatures. It would be neurotic to do that.
Who's called since you came here?
Oh, everybody. This is a great place for what one of the village men has called old maids and widows buying up bits of places and doing of them up. And so all these ladies will call. It's rather like Cranford in that there are very few gentlemen to the square inch. The ladies do all that is necessary while the few gentlemen lurk in the background.
So who has called? Has the vicar called?
Oh, yes, the vicar called only last night when I was trying to prepare myself a little for this talk. He also brought his wife and his mother-in-law.
And you have to give them tea?
Oh, yes, tea and beer and sherry and whatever there is.
What time do they call?
Well, it's very curious. I can't think when they have their dinner. They call at the time when one would naturally be cooking one's own dinner or eating it.
How long after you moved in did the first person call on you?
Oh, very soon, but it's a very well-organised village in this, that polite inquiries are made at first as to how soon you will be ready to be called upon.
And how is that done?
That is done by the contacts you already have in the village.
A sort of grapevine.
Yes, my friend had a sister-in-law here already who warned us against all the tiresome people and told us about all the nice ones and ran our first few teas for us and generally put us all regled with all our neighbours, which was very useful indeed.
And so how long after you arrived here did you let them call?
Well, after about 3 weeks, we allowed a small stream to trickle through, and then we gave two great teas which took care of all our necessary return invitations. And now I'm afraid we must brace ourselves up and think of some other return invitations.
Do you take part in the village activities, the Women's Institute, for example?
Well, I won't belong to the Women's Institute because it wastes one's time, and with me, to waste time is simply to waste bread and butter. I must work in order to live, and work long hours, too. But I will not refuse to do things when they want one to give a talk and that kind of thing, because they're always in want of handy speakers, and I think one should help in those ways.
What do you think are the problems, the difference between a woman writing poetry and a man writing poetry?
Oh, a very great difference indeed. I regard the poetess, I like the word poetess, I regard her as an ill-fated person, by and large. From the days of Sappho, who threw herself from the Leucadian promontory, wasn't it? Until our own time, because, to begin with, poetry itself is a masculine subject. The poet, in his hieratic singing robes, is a male prophet. And I think a female poet is a very great peculiarity in nature. And I think the world at large feels it too, because although poets will always have a sort of a certain amount of recognition for their Beausier, they'll always find kind ladies who will entertain them and subsidise them. Can you imagine a kind gentleman subsidising a lady poet for the sake of her Beausier? Myself, I cannot, so we tend to be very lone wolves, I think.
Would you say you're a religious person?
Oh, yes, yes, I'm a practising member, a communicating member of the Church of England. Well, I haven't always been. Brought up as I was with socialist parents who were London school teachers, they did think it rather clever not actually to believe, though we were made to go to church in order, as they said, to find out for ourselves about it. And though my parents never went to church regularly, I think it was there in their background, more than they thought.
But in spite of these vicissitudes in your religious background, Had you been baptised?
Oh, yes, because our parents discovered that we couldn't get a scholarship. We hadn't been baptised, so we were all done in a row, done in a batch. And I remember it perfectly.
And when were you confirmed?
Oh, I was confirmed only about 10 years ago. I was very depressed, because the war had destroyed our good business.
Now, this is the last war, this
yes,
last war.
Yes, this last war. The good business, which we'd built up with such hard work and so much against the grain in my case, was, of course, destroyed by the war, and I was then of an age to be liable to be called up for work. And my friend and I got a job in a factory just over the river in Chelsea. And it was really very tough because we were earning only a fraction of what we'd been accustomed to earn. There were air raids at night. The factory was dark and dirty. And I remember thinking, well, I must find somebody or something, because like this I cannot go on. I stopped in the middle of Battersea Bridge one dreadful March night, and it was cold and the wind was howling through the bridge and it was as dark as the pit, and I stood and leaned against the parapet and thought, like this I cannot go on. And it didn't come to me at once, but sometime afterwards I heard the broadcast talks of C.S. Lewis, and I at once grappled them to my soul, as Shakespeare says. And I used to assemble the family to hear, because I thought they were so good that even from the point of view of enjoyment, people shouldn't miss them. And I got every word of his that I could. And I could see by hard argument that there was only the one way for it. I had to be intellectually satisfied as well as emotionally, because at that time of life, one doesn't just fall into it in adolescent emotion. And I was satisfied at every point that it was the one way and the hard way to do things, that it wasn't the easy road, but that it was the only possible one. And so I went to the old parson in the parish where we then had our country home, and I said, I wish to be confirmed. And he was so pleased, he at once produced a very rich confirmation veil from a bottom drawer and flung it over his delicious prey with a gesture of delight.
And did you find it the what you were looking for on Battersea Bridge?
No, I see now, yes, I'm on the way to it, but I see now it's a long process. There's a great deal to be pulled down before it can be built up, and one has started very late in life, and one has fixed habits. It's a dreadful thing to get religion in middle age, but there's so much to be undone. And it's a case of, Lord, I believe, help thou mine unbelief.
What are you undoing?
Oh, I'm trying to undo my egoism, the egoism of all poets and all artists.
Do you mean your vanity?
Yes, that's part of it.
Is that very great, really?
Oh, I think very great, though I've got to the stage where I'm conscious of it now and can laugh at it. What the soul asks is perfectly inordinate. The soul is guaranteed the sum total of everything, if she will but consent. And it is to consent that is the difficult part. To win oneself away from oneself, then one inherits everything.
Our next BBC Sound Archives LP, 22981, has only got Ruth Pitter on the back. First, I shall have to play the front. This is a talk by the Right Honourable Isaac Foote from the series The Southern Counties, number 3, Devon, broadcast on the BBC General Overseas Service on the 28th of January 1956, having been recorded on the 4th of January 1956. 12 minutes and 46 seconds.
Of course, the first place to which I would take him would be Plymouth Hoe. I spent so much of my time when I was a boy on Plymouth Hoe. My home was very near Plymouth Hoe. I was born in Knott Street, a very historic street. And I could slip up on the Hoe in such little time. And there I was very often alone. I remember when the statue of Drake was put up for the first time. And I got to know Francis Drake pretty well from that time on. And I saw the beauty of the place at sunrise and at sunset. And the first place to which I would take anyone would, of course, be Plymouth Hoe. There is the difference of the light upon it. The Plymouth Sound never looks the same. It varies from day to day. And the hills upon the one side and about Edgecombe upon the other. There is such a change from day to day in its beauty. Quite manifest there. Someone who came from any part of the world and wanted to see Devon. Quite obvious, I would have to go, first of all, to Plymouth Hoe. But after Plymouth, I would then go to the other places I think associated with my childhood. I had some relatives at Horribridge, and my arrangements were such that my holidays had to be with friends. And Horribridge was the place where my father had been born. And I looked upon Horribridge as being the hub of the universe. And I got to know Horribridge. Every summer, the wonder of it, the place where the water came from. I used to bring the water down for my aunt from the spouting well there just in the hill above. And there at Horribridge, there was the street leading to the bridge. The bridge seems very small bridge today, but then I thought it was a most wonderful structure. And the bridge at that time was the sort of center for the conversation of the village. They have the town halls, the village halls today, and the institutes and all the rest. But at that time, the bridge was the place where people made to converse. Well, I got interested in the bridges, and particularly in the river. And I would go down and look at the river, wonder where it came from and where it was going. I didn't know at that time that it joined the Tavy later on, and then went into the Tamer, and that it went to wash the foreshore with other water of my own beloved Plymouth. But ever since, I've been interested in the river, and so much so that I've written down in the course of my life, I have the practice of writing down anything that appeals to me because of its beauty. I've written down in my commonplace books all that has been written by the poets upon the river, and in particular what's been written by our West Country poets upon the river. That's why I've rejoiced in the writing of Sir John Squire, who wrote a magnificent poem upon the rivers, but in the end he came back not to the great rivers of the world, but to the small rivers. And his poetry upon that, I think, is very beautiful. Have you heard it? I remember how it concludes here, where he says, "No, even were they Ganges and Amazon, in all their great might and majesty, league upon league of wonders, I would lose them all and more, for a light chiming of small bell, and a twisting flash in the granite, and the tiny thread of a pixie waterfall that lives by Vixen Tor." And then he went on to speak about the rivers at Tavistock and elsewhere. How many a hillside streamlet there falls with a broken tinkle, falling and dying, in little cascades and pools. Where the world is firs and heather, and flashing plovers and fixed larks, and an empty sky, whitish blue, that small world rules. There, there, where the high-waste boglands and the drooping slopes and the spreading valleys and the orchards and the cattle-sprinkled pastures those travelling musics fill, this is my lost Abana, and there is my nameless papa that mixed with my heart when I was a boy and time stood still. That's how he writes about those rivers. And, I've been interested in all the rivers of the world when I've been abroad. And so wherever I've gone, I've tried to see the river. these big rivers, but I come back, like Squire does, to the small river. And I think most of the little streams that I know. Particularly the little stream down below Birch Tor, 2.5 miles beyond Post Bridge, where I had to stay in the company of a mine captain and his family. That taught me a great deal when I was a boy, because there it was, I was not only on the moor, but I was on the moor alone. And the only time to see Dartmoor is to see it when you're alone, and to see it particularly, if you can, when you're a boy, when you're very young, and to see it, if you can, against the sunrise. And therefore, that little stream that runs in that valley that used to work those tin mines, that is the poetry that appeals to me. Of course, it's a great thing to come and see Devon, and those who come in their coaches and their cars come through their main road and the rest, but if they want to see Devon, they must leave their cars or take their chance and do some walking. And in particular, see these places, if they can, in the sunrise. I remember once when I was about 7 years of age and my elder brother was 9, that we had to walk home from our holidays beyond Post Bridge, and there was no means of travelling. We had to walk, and it happened to be on a very wet day. And we took with us, on that 6-mile walk, I think it was an 8.5-mile walk, because I think we walked from Birch Tor to Princetown. That's 8.5 miles, 6 of it along the main road. And it happened to be the driving rain. Our umbrella, our single umbrella, was blown to ribbons. But we had to walk that on that journey. And we were soaked to the skin. But we had one present for our mother, and that was a biscuit tin full of whortleberries, urch they call them, full of whortleberries. And we were determined that whatever happened, that the tin should be taken home, and it was taken home. It meant, of course, not merely the walk to Princetown, but then the journey along the Princetown Railway down to Yeovertown, and then changing then into Plymouth before we got to our home in Knott Street. I remember that. And sometimes when I go along that journey, as very often I do now, 2 or 3 times a month in a car, and do it in a few minutes. I think the only way to know that road and to know the moor is to know it in driving rain, as we did when I was a boy. I like to think that Coleridge, when he was a boy, went out and spent one night in the woods, right in the depth of summer. And during that night he heard the music. And he traced the music and traced it to a tiny stream. And it sang all night. And he remembered it afterwards when he wrote a poem, not about the woods of Devonshire, but about the distant seas and the ancient mariner. But he went on with beautiful language and some of the simplest and shortest words of English speech. It ceased, he said, and still the sails made on, a quiet noise till noon, a noise as of a hidden brook in the leafy month of June, that to the sleeping woods all night singeth a quiet tune. That was Coleridge, but there was another boy later on, near our own time. His name was Arthur Quiller Couch. We always think of him, of course, as a Cornishman, but really he had a Devonshire mother, and he was half Devonshire and educated in Devonshire. I had a great love for Quiller Couch, but he got his inspiration, strangely enough, not in Cornwall, but in Devon. I don't know if you remember what he said, how when he was a Devonshire schoolboy up at Newton Abbot, he went to the Bradley Woods. And he says he was met that afternoon by a vision. He too was alone. It was nothing more than sunlight slanting down a broad glade between two woodlands that drowsed in the summer heat. But it held me at gaze while the mere beauty of it flooded into my veins, and the mysterious bliss of it shook my young body. Well, of course, the characters that I would like to introduce were those perhaps I used to hear of from my father. My father was born in Horribridge, and when he was a boy, he recalled so many things that happened just in that immediate neighborhood. there used to be a skittle alley in the what was known as Blanchard's London Inn. And he, quite an interloper, would slip in just to watch the game and hear what was said. And he's told me again and again of the wit and humor of these people. I remember he's telling me about one man there whose name was George, who was one of the men who had come back as a miner. At that time, there was great emigration, very great emigration to South Africa, where people worked in the mines for some time and generally came back with the miner's disease. It didn't kill them, but it meant that they got whiter and whiter, and often they'd be seen sitting in the side of the hedge, recovering. But George, sitting there very white, was watching the game, and in came one of his neighbors, who greeted him and said, "Well, George, how are you?" "Not very well," he said. "Not long for this world, I'm afraid." "Oh," he said, "Dammy, you've been saying that for the last 20 years. You'll go to all our funerals before you finish, I reckon. And when you die, you'll go straight to heaven." "Well," he said, "what makes you say that?" And he said, "Well, the book says that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of heaven. And you, nothing but skin and bone." That was the conversation that my father once recalled. I can't imagine any deaf man who would wish to have been born elsewhere, George. And yet, there is that a strange devotion to one's own place. For instance, he was brought home to me once just after Dunkirk, when the soldiers coming from Dunkirk were brought down to the West Country. Much to their disgust, they wanted to go north, those who belonged to the Northern Regiment. And I remember on one occasion drawing into Tavistock one evening. We had come in with thousands. We came into Tavistock, which I think is the most beautiful station in England, with its river down below and its church and all its suggestion in the hills beyond. But I heard one of these men, it was the Durham Light Infantry, call out to the other and say, "What station's this, Jock?" And he said, "Stockton-on-Tees." And the voice came back, "I wish to God it was." Which is a reminder to me that there were other places beside Devonshire. But Stockton-on-Tees, compared with Tavistock, I think would be a difficult problem.
The back of BBC Sound Archives LP 22981... is a talk by Ruth Pitter on the subject of George Orwell, introduced by A.W. Russell, broadcast on London Calling Asia on the 3rd of January 1956. No recording date is given, so I assume it's the same date. 17 minutes and 2 seconds.
Good evening. George Orwell has become a portentous name in our time, and especially in the 5 years since his death. He was the left-wing idealist who joined the Burma police and resigned for reasons of conscience, who fought for the Popular Front in the Spanish War, and years later devoted his best talents to a savage satirical attack on communism. I don't think any satirist has made such an impact on English thought since Dean Swift wrote Gulliver's Travels. You probably know Orwell's two masterpieces. 1984, a brilliant, gloomy, imaginative novel about life in Britain under a totalitarian regime of the future, and Animal Farm, in which all the farmyard beasts go through a process of revolution and tyranny on the Bolshevik pattern. Animal Farm has been made into a popular cartoon film, and 1984 created a profound impression as a television play here in Britain a year or two ago. We have here in the studio somebody who knew George Orwell well in the days before his fame and brief prosperity. Ruth Pitter, the distinguished poetess, recipient of the Hawthornden Prize and the Heinemann Award, and just recently of the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry. She's going to recount some of her personal memories. Miss Pitter.
I first saw Orwell, or Eric Blair, to give him his real name, in 1920. He was then about 17. A young woman who worked with me knew his parents. They were neighbours of hers in the block of flats where she lived in the Notting Hill Gate district of London. Orwell's elder sister and her husband also had a flat there for a time, and I suppose they'd asked my friend and me to supper. The outer doors of the flats opened almost directly into the sitting rooms. So, the moment our hostess let us in, I saw a tall youth, with hair the colour of hay and a brown tweed suit, standing at a table by the window, cleaning a sporting gun. There was something arresting in the way he looked up. His eyes were blue and rather formidable, and an exact pair. Most people's eyes are not. His sight was very keen, as I learned afterwards. He was, of course, still at school, and I can't remember if I saw him again before he joined the Burma police. But the idea of Orwell as an interesting person was indelibly stamped on my mind. As we all know, he left the Burma police after about 5 years' service. To my surprise, I had a letter from him at this time, asking if I remembered him. He wanted us to find him a cheap lodging. We found a bedroom in a poor street, next door to a house our employers used as an arts and crafts workshop. I have a clear picture in my mind of Orwell lugging some heavy suitcases into our workshop house, no doubt to sort out the contents more easily than he could have done in the cramped bedroom next door. He was now a very tall man. He had the same rather formidable, perhaps defensive look, and the very wide terai hat he was still wearing made him look still more imposing. He was far from well, even then. I don't think the tropics suited him, but I think he was also sick with rage. He was convinced that we had no business to be in Burma, no right to dominate other nations. He would have ended the British Raj then and there. That winter was very cold. Orwell had very little money indeed. I think he must have suffered in that unheated room after the climate of Burma, though we did rather belatedly lend him an oil stove. He said afterwards that he used to light a candle to try and warm his hands when they were too numbed to write. Oh yes, he was already writing. Trying to write, that is, it didn't come easily. At this time, I don't think any of his friends believed he would ever write well. Indeed, I think he was unusually inept. We tried not to be discouraging, but we used to laugh till we cried at some of the bits he showed us. You must remember that we were hard-working women older than he. To us at that time, he was a wrong-headed young man who had thrown away a good career and was vain enough to think he could be an author. But the formidable look was not there for nothing. He had the gift, he had the courage, he had the persistence to go on in spite of failure, sickness, poverty, and opposition until he became an acknowledged master of English prose. Orwell's parents had now left London and were living at Southwold on the Suffolk coast. My friend's parents had a house there too, and our employers had a small business close by. We used to work there for some weeks during the summer. We were all on visiting terms, so that we saw Orwell fairly often, one way and another. He was very good company in the countryside. I remember so well his taking me straight to a nightjar's nest in a featureless sea of vegetation. The nest was just a little hollow in the ground with one egg and one young bird, a very queer young bird with an enormous mouth, funny whiskers, and a valiant hiss. I expect Orwell had taken bearings on the nest, but he must have watched the old birds patiently to find it in the first place. Seeing the nest was a nice change from squabbling about D.H. Lawrence, which we had been doing briskly as we came along. Orwell thought the world of him, while to me Lawrence was always a gifted writer indeed, but no prophet. I have one memory of Orwell which is out of series, so to speak, of Orwell at a place which he visited only once, This was a small cottage in Essex which my family had as a weekend home for years. It was in the forest. There are considerable remnants of ancient forest in Essex, which of course are now piously preserved. The party consisted of Orwell, my brother, myself, and I think my mother. It was fine spring weather, and there were plenty of flowers. I think we were all happy. The place was very small, so the two men shared a room. My brother told me afterwards that he thought Orwell's body very beautiful. The cottage was very old and decayed then, but a remnant is still standing. I saw it again about 2 years ago. A bomb had shaken down half of it, and some enterprising person had evidently patched up the remainder without benefit of architectural advice. It was a pathetic sight. To think how fond we were of it. It was the real centre of life for me and my family for many years, and Orwell, the most famous man we have ever known, actually stayed there. He is dead, and the place is in ruins. It seems strange to be still alive and well oneself. By 1930, my friend and I had started a business of our own in Chelsea. Orwell used to turn up now and then. He liked our large workshop. I remember his changing into very shabby clothes in its shadowy recesses prior to some excursion into the seamy side of life. He didn't look in the least like a poor man. God knows he was poor, but the formidable look didn't go with the rags. He left in the workshop a suitcase full of clothes. To our feminine eyes, the most deplorable clothes. He would write from time to time and ask for various choice items to be sent on. Now and then, he would ask me to go out with him. I've lively recollections of these occasions, at the same time heartrending and comic. You see, he hardly ever had enough money, and it was terrible to him to let a woman pay. I used to take picnic lunches and help as tactfully as I could, but the heart-rending element would come in. I used to think, well, if it's so awful, why doesn't he get a proper job? This, of course, was very bourgeois. By this time, Orwell had had several bouts of pneumonia, and I knew very well that he would never make old bones. I remember one perfectly horrible winter day with melting snow on the ground and an icy wind. Orwell had no proper overcoat, no hat, gloves or muffler. I felt quite sure he was in what is called the pre-tubercular condition. And here he was, exposing himself to such weather in totally inadequate clothing. It wasn't just poverty, it was suicidal perversity. More than once I made an open attack on him, trying to get him to take proper advice and attend to his health. All in vain. He would never face the facts. On one occasion, he was tested for TB, but the result proved negative, or so he said. He never had proper treatment until it was too late. My mind is full of pictures of him on these various outings. There he is, sitting on the canal bank, fishing, but shaking with silent laughter at something he's overheard as two women pass behind him on the towpath. He leans in the twilight on the parapet of Chelsea Embankment and says that the trees in Battersea Park over the river look very like the Burmese jungle. Sometimes he looks well, young and gay, sometimes quite grey and desperate. In the bus, I sneak the money for our fares into his hand. Ah, today he has some money. We have lunch in a restaurant, and even a bottle of wine. Now he is penniless again, and I treat him to a dinner. He is furious until I remind him that he is the younger person and must put up with it. He gets a poorly paid schoolmastering job. Then pneumonia defeats him again. He's helping a bookseller out Hampstead way. And there's a man, or rather a boy, whom he's met in those parts. A young Welshman, a poet who has just come to London and is rather interesting. His name is Dylan Thomas. Gradually, we saw less of Orwell, and then war came. I only saw him once, between about 1935 and the time of his death in January 1950. It would be in the early autumn of 1942. By then, of course, he had been married for some years to Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who died before him. I had met her at the BBC, where he also was working, and she'd asked me to supper. They were living in a damp basement flat. She was worried about the rent. It was £100 a year, and she said they couldn't afford it. He was known as a writer now, but not to the extent of getting much out of it. Eileen was a small, slender woman with nice, clear Irish features and rather curly, dark hair. She told me about his recent illness. She'd not realised what a sick man he was, and a sudden, severe hemorrhage had terrified her. The last straw was that when he'd been got off to hospital, she looked for the cat to hold in her arms for a little consolation. But it had disappeared, and she never saw it again. Eileen had been through a bad time and was soon to die herself. She didn't have much of a share in Orwell's brief time of success and prosperity. When he was wounded so badly in the Spanish War, she actually managed to get out there to nurse him. She took a job in Madrid and, I suppose, earned some sort of living for both of them. While we were talking and working away at cooking the supper, I remember part of it was apple pie, and she was nervously anxious not to leave a scrap of core in the apples, as she said he disliked it so. While we were working and talking, Orwell came in, like a ghost. No doubt he was showing the effects of his recent illness. And of course he did live another 7 or 8 years, but I thought then that he must be dying. The emaciation, the waxen pallor, the slow, careful movements, all shocked and distressed me. But he seemed cheerful, fetched some beer, and went out again to see if his mother would come in. She was living close by. I had brought with me 2 things impossible to buy in London at that time, a good bunch of grapes from my mother's home in Essex, and a red rose, 2 rare treasures. I can see him now, holding up the grapes with a smile of admiration and delight on his ravaged face, and then cupping the rose in his wasted hands, breathing in the scent with a kind of reverent joy. That is the last vivid image I have of him. After that evening, I never saw him again. I never knew him as the immensely successful author he became. How he did adore life! His nature was divided. There was something like a high wall right across the middle of it. A high wall with flowers and fruit and running water on one side and the desert on the other. I think he was much more fastidious and conventional than one might think from his work, more than he knew himself, not liking any core left in the apple pie, for instance. And do you remember in Down and Out in Paris and London how he threw away the milk, which was the only food he had, simply because a bedbug had fallen into it? Too fastidious for a starving man. And his anger at the idea of letting a woman pay. That was very conventional. His funeral was simply the orthodox Anglican ceremony, and he was buried by his own wish where he was born. His iconoclastic, rebellious attitude, which became much less political after the Spanish War, was what I call a blood feud for joy. He felt the loveliness of life so keenly that he couldn't endure the evils which are always denying and frustrating it, and he was sorely bewildered. He didn't really know where to place the blame, for the idea of original sin was unacceptable to him, and he hadn't got round yet to considering misfortune as a discipline and charity as a duty. His attitude was really very like Thomas Hardy's, I think, only more militant, an honourable 19th century scepticism and pessimism. Rather old-fashioned, but he was rather an old-fashioned man. The generations in his family, owing to a succession of late marriages, were very long, and his father's father was born in the 18th century. So that Orwell's forebear, the celebrated Edinburgh divine Hugh Blair, Dr. Johnson's friend and contemporary, whose long, solemn poem, The Grave, was illustrated by William Blake, This supremely respectable Scotsman was only 3 or 4 generations distant from him. Orwell's great virtue, it seems to me, was that he would not let things go by default, as we nearly all do. He threw all his forces into the battle for truth. Once he was convinced that we had no business in Burma, out he came. Never mind the sacrifice of his career. Time serving in any form he hated and rejected with all his force. It was a pure scientific honesty, very rare in literature.
Our next BBC Sound Archives disc is a 78 RPM one, number 22710. The front has 2 bands from the programme Second Sight. Band 1, Wendy Wood, on an unheeded warning, 2 minutes 48 seconds. And Band 2, a prophetic story by Donald Sinclair of Tyree, 1 minute 27 seconds. Recorded and broadcast on the 24th of December 1955.
There was one that had so many people that could verify it that it might be interesting from that point of view. I was in a house, and there was a stranger there whom I didn't know, a young man. And we had tea, and then as I was going, I just felt as if I couldn't go through the open door. If it had been made of steel, it couldn't have sort of repelled me more. And I realized that I just suddenly saw part of a little sort of harbour, a pier that's called Dalalay, that's up on Loch Shiel. And I saw this man getting his leg terribly hurt. Now, I didn't know how. And this is rather an interesting point. I made a pot shot and I said it might be with a hawser. Well, I was just making up that piece. All I knew was that the agony, that his leg was going to be terribly hurt at Dalalay. And I thought, I had been told he was the engineer on the boat that goes up the loch. So I said to him, will you promise me you won't go on the boat? Oh, he laughed. He said, oh, you're quite astray, because I've retired and I've got nothing whatever now to do with a boat at all. So that it's anything to do with a boat's quite out of the question. So don't worry yourself. Well, I turned to go again. And again, I just couldn't get through the door. I just couldn't force myself to go through the door. And I turned round and said to him, you're not believing me. Well, everybody stopped and listened. I said, will you remember, don't go on the boat. He said, all right, all right, all right. I won't go on the boat then. And I turned, and this time I could go out of the door, but I still felt a little bit depressed about it. Well, that was on a Sunday afternoon, and I think it was on the Friday. The man who was the new engineer on the boat couldn't get the boat turned to get her out of the pier at Aharachal. So he called on this man if he would please put her into reverse and get her out. So he clean forgot, and he went on the boat and he took her as far as Dalalay. And at Dalalay he was going to step out of the engine room when his foot slipped and his leg went under the fly wheel and was almost amputated on the spot, and he was dead before he got to Fort William. Now, I don't know what to say. I still say if he would have remembered and he hadn't gone on the boat, it wouldn't have happened. Because other people say, well, of course, if you saw it, it had to happen. But I'm not at all convinced. I think to a very great extent, it's a gift that is given for warnings, because I've seen it work that way. But people just simply won't remember. It's very distressing.
I was once hurt in cattle when I was a young boy at a farm in Tyree. And I was sleeping all alone in a on the lower ground. And I was always troubled with noises at night. And I was complaining it was cats or dogs that was doing it. But this night I was fully awake. And I've seen this man in the bedroom. And I've never seen him before in my life. And of course I got a bit scared, But at the long last, I got so much acquainted with this ghost that I was not paying much heed to him. So I left the place, and a year or two after that, the body of a man was washed ashore below the farm. And the old man of the farm, he brought home the body of this man, and it was placed in the same room I was sleeping for a day or two. That's one thing I knew to my own experience.